my talk is Theory and Practice of Adaptive Regulatory Networks, but the implied addition to that title is And the Gap in Between. So I want to talk about the gap, which is very much needed, and which also needs to be filled. And I'll continue the progress in the amount of jet lag of the speakers this morning, starting with Mark Newman, and upping the ante a bit to about 9 hours or so. So if I keel over, you know, just pour some hot coffee over me, and I'll be okay. Why look at regulatory networks? Well, regulatory networks, first of all, a definition. Regulatory networks mean links between genes, which encode an influence in the sense that gene 1 is expressed and a protein is produced, and that protein influences the expression of gene 2, 3, and 4. Why look at those networks? Well, the major motivation for looking at regulatory networks is the big surprise which came out of the genomic sequencing projects of the recent decade or so, which found that higher organisms, by and large, share the same set of genes. And that's not just human and mouse, which have about 99% of their gene set in common, but even if you look at very distant organisms like yeast and humans, humans have 40% of the genes which you find in yeast. And that really changes something whenever I open a fridge and there's some, you know, baker's yeast inside. It looks at me and it has 40% of its genes are also in me. That means phenotypic differences don't just simply stem in a straightforward way from the genes which we have. So it's very unlikely there's a gene for being furry and having long whiskers, which only mice have and humans don't have it, but rather the phenotypic differences between organisms stem from how, when, and where genes are expressed. This means they differ in the regulatory interactions between genes which cause those differences. Now, as an idea, this emphasis on interaction networks, and in particular regulatory networks, goes back a long time to the 1970s. What makes this a very interesting time to look at regulatory interactions again is the amount of data on gene expression levels which comes from microarray experiments. Now, microarrays are small chips, a couple of centimeters squared in size, on which by micro-machining processes and all sorts of clever photoelectrics, people place a huge number of probes, millions of probes, one or two or three for each gene, and then measure, using these probes, the expression levels of all genes in one given probe. Here's an example showing a very small part of such a completed chip experiment where the light probes indicate that the corresponding gene has a high expression level and dark probes correspond to genes which have a low expression level. Now, these chips have become very cheap. They cost about $1,000 each. They're now even used in diagnostics and all sorts of applications. And there's a vast amount of data on these expression levels which is stored in databases and by and large underanalyzed so far. Well, what causes those expression levels? At the very bottom, it's the interaction between certain proteins, which are called transcription factors, and the regulatory DNA found in front of a gene. And that interaction is a physical interaction in the sense that this transcription factor is going to seek out and bind to a very specific sequence in the genome, provided that the sequence here in the regulatory region matches some target sequence, matches the surface of that transcription factor. This means changes in the regulatory region at the level of the sequence may change the interaction, the transcription factor no longer binds, and that might destroy the regulatory interaction between this protein here and its target gene. Now, that's just the molecular basis. At the simplest level, one transcription factor and one, in this case, just a section of a regulatory region of a gene. Things get very complicated when we start linking up several genes in this fashion when transcription factors regulate other transcription factors, which may then have some sort of feedback before, in the end, enzymes, other proteins are encoded, which actually do things in the cell. And here there's a very small part of the regulatory network of the sea urchin, which has been painstakingly assembled over the last 20 years or so by Eric Davidson's lab at Caltech. And we already see that a list of links just by themselves isn't going to tell us very much. We don't understand immediately what sets of genes are responsible for what sets of properties of this organism. So the link between the regulatory interaction, even though we know the basic biophysical mechanisms at play, don't tell us immediately what the output is. And now we have, if you want, an inverse problem, that we have a lot of data on the output of a regulatory interaction network. We have some idea about the basic mechanisms causing those expression levels. What we would like to know is what are the regulatory interactions behind the expression patterns, and what are the properties of those networks which emerge, and what are sets of interactions which code for very specific functions. That's a vast task. I'm simply using this to outline the challenges ahead. I won't make any headway in the solution of this problem, but the reason I'm drawing up these three levels is there's now both a dynamic problem and a static problem which we have to look at. The interactions are coded by the sequence, are encoded by the regulatory sequence, which is subject to random changes when there's random mutations occurring at the level of DNA here. Yet, the final product, the organism, has to produce certain genes at certain times in order to, for instance, metabolize or catabolize certain needed products in the organism, or to execute the complicated dance of development when the embryo grows. And that is a static problem in the sense that the need to live, to function, is more or less constant, yet compatible with it is some sort of dynamics, a random evolutionary dynamics at the level of sequences. But what are the properties of this interplay between sequence dynamics and expression patterns? Here's a little bit of insight coming from experiments on, in this case, the yeast S. cerevisiae, and doing a comparison between this one species of yeast and some other species of yeast, which is called S. pombi. They are very, very distantly related, so just because they're two yeasts, it doesn't mean they're very close organisms. In fact, the evolutionary distance between those two species is about the same as between yeast and human, so they're hugely distant. But what one finds when looking at expression patterns is that there are sets of genes which have very similar expression patterns, and the counterpart, the related genes in between S. cerevisiae and S. pombi have a very similar clustering property on these expression patterns. One can see this here. The y-axis is a list of genes, so each row here corresponds to one gene, and those genes have very similar expression patterns in the sense that in different samples plotted along the along the x-axis, the genes tend to be either on or off, but they tend to do so together. So they're highly correlated. If one looks at the counterparts, so-called homologs, of those genes, of the genes in this cluster in S. cerevisiae, and looks at their expression patterns in S. pombi, they also tend to be clustered. So despite the vast evolutionary distance between those two organisms,
in the same way, clustered?
Well, that's a hard thing to tell, because the underlying this simple level, we can simply say they point in the same direction. But the mapping from organism to organism involves this, some highly non-trivial transformation between expression, between the two expression spaces. So the simple statement one can make immediately is those genes which cluster in this organism here also cluster in the other organism. That's a remarkable result, especially because when you look at the binding sites for the genes driving the expression of genes in that cluster and in that cluster, they tend to be very, they turn out to be very different from each other. And here's an evolutionary tree where on one side you have SREBCA, by the way, that's Baker's yeast. So that's the stuff which those of us who bake have in their fridge. And on the other side you have this far, this distant relative as Pombi. And here's genes which act as transcription factor for the cluster of genes which was shown on the previous page. And when one looks at the occurrence of binding sites for those transcription factors, there is a break where this binding site here suddenly disappears in S. Pombi and its close relatives. It's not there in S. cerevisiae and its relatives and its close relatives. It is present. On the other hand, you have a new regulatory interaction encoded in an entirely new binding site, which is present mainly on the S. pombi side, and then there's a third binding site which is actually present along the entire phylogenetic tree linking those two organisms.
Now these are all expressions of genes which are present in all these kinds of yeast forms. So the genes
The genes are the same in this up to mutations, but you can trace the common evolutionary ancestry due to similarity at the level of sequence. So you can say the two genes in those two clusters, say this one in the list here, has a sequence relative, has a related gene with a similar sequence in the other yeast. And it's also part, and if you look at the set of genes in this cluster here, there's a cluster of genes with also similar expression patterns, which is highly enriched in the genes found in this cluster.
So even though, since you said they have the same distance, these two, they only have 45% agreement with each other, just because you, well, you said the distance between these two yeast is the same as between them and us, which you said is 45%.
But there you have to, it's not, now the question is what measure of agreement do you use? I was saying 40% of the genes in yeast have a counterpart in human. What one really has to compare is the sequence distance, so how many mutations have occurred between those two guys, simply because humans have many more genes than yeast. So yeast genes number about 6,000, human genes about 25,000. So when comparing the sheer numbers, one also has to account for genome expansion and then look at sequence similarity. But it's absolutely true, not all genes which are in this cluster are also present in this cluster.
So you said there was a difference between these are the sequences and the binding sites?
Well, in the next picture here, there is binding overrepresented sequences which correspond to known transcription factors which occur in the regulatory regions of the genes in that particular cluster. So for instance, in most regulatory regions in SREBCA, you do find a binding site to which the transcription factor RAP1 binds. But as you go along the phylogenetic tree, at some point that binding site is lost. And some other binding site for an entirely different transcription factor emerges.
So that means that first the RAP1 is no longer expressed as I go that way?
It may be expressed, but it no longer drives the expression of that cluster, and some other transcription factor is taken over. So a very simple graphic representation might be, here you have the cluster of genes which are co-expressed. In one species, those are, and I'm being hugely simplistic here, those are driven by Rab1, and in some other species, they are driven, maybe with a different topology, by some entirely different transcription factor. So there's an surprising, if you ask me, a very surprising amount of flexibility at the level of interaction networks. A turnover of binding sites, new links emerging, old ones disappearing, yet at the level of the output, in that case measured by the cluster and the genes contained in the cluster, the output remains the same. That's a very good question. In this study, people didn't look at the binding strength, which is a very hard thing to do. One thing one might do is look at the conservation of those motifs. I don't think that was done. Apart from that, one would have to go into the biophysics, and that is very poorly understood. But it's a very good question. If you have more binding sites, do the binding energies, and therefore also the amount of conservation of individual binding sites, do they go down? Now, if there's a binding site turnover with new links emerging quickly and old ones also disappearing, the first question which I want to ask comes from the dynamical side and asks, what is the dynamics at the level of sequences which can quickly generate a new binding site? And suppose the binding site has some target sequence. A good binding sequence for one given transcription factor might be this sequence here, ATT, GC, AG, and so on. And now, target of some evolutionary process, or aim of some evolutionary process, is to generate this sequence or something reasonably similar to it somewhere in the regulatory sequence. And in the beginning, you start with something entirely random, maybe this sequence here, GT, CC, AA, and so on. And there's some overlap in a couple of places which just emerges by chance. Here there's a T, here's an A. They match just by chance. And since there's four nucleotides, at about every fourth position, you'd expect to have such a match just by chance. And now mutations. Mutations are random and convert one of the nucleotides into some other nucleotide. For instance, if you go from a C in this position to an A, that increases the binding affinity. So this mutation is beneficial and might get fixed in the population, and then maybe there's some other mutation. It's also beneficial. There's another one which goes from a match to a mismatch, so you lose a little bit of binding affinity, and so on. This dynamics is stochastic because it's driven by random mutations. But of course, it diffuses towards a definite aim in the sense that those organisms with a higher binding, or with a sequence which has a higher binding affinity, do better in the competition with other organisms. So there's a bias in the fixation probability towards sequences with a higher binding affinity. Well, a very simple model on this binding on the relationship between binding affinity and fitness is simply to make the fitness proportional to the binding probability of the transcription factor at some concentration. Say the transcription factor is on at a certain number of copies per volume, and the question is the sequence good enough, close enough to the target sequence to bind it, and then you have a relationship between binding probability 1 at very low sequences and 0 at very high differences from the target sequence. And if you make the fitness proportional to the binding probability, that gives you a very simple sigmoid curve of fitness against the Hamming distance, the total number of mismatches at the level of the sequence. Once you have a simple model for the fitness, you can ask what is the rate of point substitutions under population dynamics, and that has been calculated a long time ago by Kimura and Ota, a classic result of genetics, which I'm not going to
show.
Yes. So F over S is the fitness expressed in units of some selection coefficient. Essentially, what I'm plotting here is the binding probability in the at some high concentration of the transcription factor, and I'm saying that the fitness is equal to the binding probability times some constant, which is called S. And the probability, or rather the, in this case, the rate of a mutation corresponding to a certain change in the fitness, this is maybe a mutation which goes from Hamming distance 5 to 4 over here, is given by a simple expression in terms of the population size n, the bare mutation rate, this is number of random substitutions occurring in the population, times a function of the change in fitness, which if you plot it has a very simple shape. For very large changes of the fitness, it's high, and for negative changes of the fitness, it tends to zero.
How good is the fitness experiment here?
I'll come to that in a second. The problem is that fitness is very hard to measure, and there is evidence that and the main problem is fitness will tend to go down with Hamming distance, and that's seen in the experiment. How close to the sigmoid function we really are, that's a different matter, and that currently can't be measured. But I'll argue later that the exact shape of this curve doesn't matter terribly much. So if we have a some bare mutation rate at which random mutations occur, and we know what fraction of those actually gets fixed in the population, then we can draw up a stochastic dynamics for the probability of a locus of a part of the regulatory sequence with a Hamming distance r from the perfect binding sequence at some time t. It's essentially the mutation rate calculated by Kimura Ota times some entropic factor, which tells us how close we are to perfect binding. And this master equation for the probability of a certain binding of a site with a certain Hamming distance r can be solved numerically. And here you see the change in r over time, where time is expressed in some convenient units. And you also see when you simulate the stochastic dynamics that there's jumps, of course, in discrete steps. You start at maybe Hamming distance 5, and eventually you go down to Hamming distance 2. What's happening there exactly? Oh, hang on, here's some comparison with experiment first. Some indirect evidence. You can, of course, compare the equilibrium distribution of the stochastic process after a long time with the distribution of Hamming distances you find for a specific transcription factor binding site, in this case, the binding site for CRP in yeast. And if you look at the neutral distribution where there's no selection acting, you just have a random distribution of Hamming distances, it's peaked at very large distances, that's the distribution of just randomly picking your sequences, then running the evolutionary dynamics for a long time gives you a distribution which is shown by the shaded bars, and the diamonds are the frequencies of Hamming distances for known targets of CRP in yeast. One interesting thing is that the best binding sequence is not the most frequent one. So it's not the perfect target which is actually most frequent in the genome. And when you go back to the fitness curve, that's obvious. There's not a lot to be gained once you're maybe at a Hamming distance at around 2 to go to a Hamming distance 0. The change in fitness is very small compared to the comparative change in fitness maybe up here. So since there's more binding sites with this larger Hamming distance, we get a peak at non-zero Hamming distances. One can calculate how long the generation of a binding site takes and express it in the number of steps in this adaptive region between where there's no binding or hardly any binding at all up to where the binding is very nearly perfect, and express it in the selection pressure, the Bayer mutation rate, and the population size. If you put in realistic numbers for some organisms, for instance, the fruit fly Drosophila melanogaster, you find that in order to generate a binding site from scratch, it takes about 10 to the 6th generations, or 10 to the 5 years, which on evolutionary timescales is extremely little. It sounds a lot to us, it's 100,000 years, but 100,000 years is only a tenth between the evolutionary distance of Drosophila melanogaster from its most close relative, Drosophila simonans, which split about 1 million years ago. So there's time to generate a binding site in one given position about 10 times over. And now we begin to understand why there's so much scope for flexibility in regulatory networks. Even given moderate selection pressures, it's very easy to generate new regulatory interactions. Now, one additional element which makes the generation of new binding site very flexible is that the regulatory region of a gene can be as long as 500 to maybe 1,000 base pairs, in some cases even longer, and the exact placement of a binding site, it doesn't matter very much. So you can, whether you place a binding site here, or you place it a little bit further upstream or downstream in the genome, doesn't matter very much. And that flexibility explains why we're not wasting a lot of time out here in the flat region. And here in the flat region, evolution is perfectly neutral. We start out maybe at a Hamming distance of 8, and then start making some steps in one direction or the other, fewer steps in the direction into which we want to go, simply because there's fewer sequences with a smaller Hamming distance. And at each of these steps, we gain nothing in terms of binding. If we're at 8 and go to 7, nothing happens. If we go from 7 to 6, still nothing happens. So the waiting time out here is a lot longer simply because evolution is entirely neutral. But what saves us from this long wait out in the desert is that it doesn't matter where exactly in the end the binding site is placed. And the more flexibility we have, the more of these processes take place in parallel, simultaneously. So having a large regulatory region also means there's a lot of seeds for good starting points, maybe very close to this point where binding just starts to occur, and one step is going to generate a binding site which functions even just a little bit, and that provides a hint into which direction to go into with the next step. So having a lot of seeds means we cut back on the time spend out here in the neutral part, and that means we can estimate the length of a regulatory region, for instance, by saying that the neutral time should be, call it T0, should be comparable to the time it takes to go from this point of hardly any binding to the point of pretty good binding. and ask, well, if we make those two times about equal, in order not to waste much time with neutral evolution, what length of the binding sequence do you get? Do you get something which is very short, or something which is unrealistically long? And the point is, if you take a binding sequence of length 8, this condition of Ts being approximately the same as T0, the neutral time, gives a regulatory region of length 300 base pairs, which is perfectly realistic. So the length of a binding region might also be influenced by the need to generate new binding sites easily.
So does this mean metaphorically that it pays to have junk DNA?
Well, regulatory regions wouldn't be called junk DNA from the start.
Right,
it pays, so the junk DNA would be the very long, I could start here and go all the way over here and continue on the blackboard several times over. That's what would be called junk DNA. And there's little evidence for binding sites in that junk DNA yet. But the statement is nevertheless correct in the sense that if you say, let's have our junk DNA start here, that boundary should be far enough away from the start of the gene in order to be able to generate binding sites easily. Now, this explains why, when you look at very long evolutionary distances, it's not surprising, at least, that the same expression patterns, the same output, is generated by very different regulatory interactions, simply because it's possible dynamically to generate those interactions.
That would be true for anything, right? Not just binding sites.
This would be true for anything, even the timescales are correct. For instance, if in this calculation here, the timescale had come out much, much bigger than the times across phylogenetic distances, so the evolutionary time between those two yeasts, then it would have been very surprising, or much more surprising than it is now, to how the binding sites could have changed. So what I'm saying is there's a lot of potential for changes of regulatory interactions which don't necessarily change the output, namely the expression patterns. This is true for anything which can be generated quickly enough, but what can be generated quickly enough is, of course, a non-trivial question.
Now, you said it's only 10 or 1% of the time, but this is just a single interaction, so to actually do your evolution, you need sort of, I don't know how many interactions,
that's
1% seems still too slow.
Hang on, 1%? What did
you
say, 1%?
You said it's 1% of the time it took, or maybe
10%. 10%.
So that seems still very slow if you think that this is just one single regular interaction.
This
the distance is how many regular interactions?
Well, in the
two?
Between the two, so this is just 10. So what I was saying here is between two very closely related organisms, Drosophila melanogaster and Drosophila simonans, you can change a binding site 10 times over. One single binding site. That's totally correct. I totally agree with that. So here the modeling is at the level of one single binding site. And in fact, I'd like to spend the rest of the talk looking at the much more difficult problem of what happens when there's many genes involved. And this is the point where I can't be as definite in terms of the modeling as I was in the first half, and just start to construct a generic model, a framework in which one can think about the changes of expression levels and the underlying regulatory interactions in order to see what changes of regulatory interactions are compatible with what sets of outputs, what sets of expression patterns. And the model is really very much stripped down, and I focus on structural genes. This is genes which encode for enzymes, which maybe are needed in order to process certain food inputs, so suppose lactose is given to the organism, in that state of the cell, you want to generate a protein which breaks down lactose and makes it and makes its energy available to the organism. So those are, if you want, the real workhorses of the cell which are needed to be turned on in some state of the cell and they needed to be turned off in some other state of the cell. Those are fixed for a given state of the cell. Another ingredient is regulatory interactions. Those are variable in the sense that we don't care what regulatory interactions we have, provided they get the job done of producing the target states of structural genes. And that's asking what is the space of interactions compatible with the target states of structural genes. And another variable is the target states of regulatory genes. Those are transcription factors whose levels, again, don't matter provided they get the job done. The job being defined as the target states of enzymes and other proteins, which actually do work in the cell and are not part of the information processing apparatus. That's a very coarse-grained splitting of the genome into two elements, one the structural genes and one the regulatory genes. It makes sense from an evolutionary point of view to do that, because it turns out the regulatory genes and the structural genes in higher organisms have different evolutionary origins and come from different ancestors. So splitting them is a procedure which is very much coarse-grained, but as a first approximation it makes sense. And then what we're after is the set of regulatory interactions for all genes which provide the correct outputs for given states of the cell, but also we have to provide those transcription factors again with their own sets of regulatory interactions. Those transcription factors for the higher level, for the transcription factors, need to be generated, etc. So we get one big connected blob of gene switching on gene, influencing another gene, and so on, until at the end of things, we are generating the expression levels of structural genes. Now that, again, is a very complicated object. We're talking about changing the regulatory interactions and the target states of regulatory genes in order to achieve a certain output of structural genes. And I'll use a very simple model in order to get some handle on this space of interactions. Again, a thermodynamic model based on older work by Shia and Acker and more recent one by David Arnosti, where the probability that a given gene I is transcribed is given by the expression levels of its transcription factors weighted with the strength of the regulatory interactions. So transcription factor J has a certain interaction strength with gene I, and then you sum over all the transcription factors in one given state of the cell, and then if this term here is very high, higher than some threshold, the probability that gene I will be transcribed is correspondingly large. And you can be a little bit more coarse-grained and make the threshold a hard one and say that gene I is expressed in this term here, the sum over transcription factors weighted with the strength of regulatory interactions is larger than some threshold, and it's off. And that should be a smaller sign here, sorry about that. And it's off.
That is a perceptron.
Okay. In fact, what makes it differ from a perceptron is that we have two levels, and that's for those of you who have a background in neural networks. We have two different levels of averaging here. One of them is the quench average, which is over the expression levels of the structural genes, those are fixed. And another one, which is annealed at the same level of the interactions, and that's the expression levels of the regulatory genes. And that's, of course, an average which couples all the interactions together. So we don't any longer have one single perceptron to look at, but we have to cover it, we have to look at the entire regulatory network, the matrix Jij, instead of just one single row of that matrix independently. That makes life a little bit harder at the formal level. Instead of having an order parameter which is just quadratic, we get a cumulant expansion which has to be summed up to infinite order, and diagrams are very helpful to do that. I'm not going to go into the detail, but go straight to the results. One of them is that there is no phase transition, unlike in the perceptron, no phase transition between solvable and unsolvable. One can always find transcription factor levels and interactions which solve a, which correctly solve the expression levels of the structural genes. And that's because we are free to choose the inputs into the regulatory network, because the if you draw your interaction matrix Jij schematically and you divide it into structural genes and into regulatory genes, then you have zeros over here, and you're entirely free to choose all the psi I mu any way you like in this sector over here. So with every new constraint, you get a new variable to play with. That's essentially the reason. There's an order parameter, in fact, the only order parameter, or the only interesting one, which gives the bias in reciprocal interactions. So it tells us that if Jij, the interaction strength between gene I and gene J is positive, the reverse interaction Ji tends to be positive too. It doesn't have to be positive, but there's a bias between the two, and the strength of that bias depends on the ratio between regulatory and structural genes and the number of encoded states. And here there's a plot showing the numerics and analytics of this order parameter H giving the bias in reciprocal interaction versus the fraction of encoded states relative to the total number of genes in the system. And and a non-trivial value of this order parameter H is actually compatible with experimental data on regulatory interactions. And here, this this figure shows the number of like reciprocal interactions in a in experimental data on yeast regulatory interactions. So this is the total number of reciprocal interactions where both tend to be on the same sign, so enhancer, repressor, and repressor, versus those where one interaction is enhancing and the other one is repressive, and there's a bias with towards a positive value of the bias Jij, Ji.
What are the error bars?
Well, you can look at the total, at the numbers here, and they would be off order root n. So the error bars are pretty big. I totally concede that. And in fact, there's all sorts of problems with this data set, also from an experimental point of view. I'm showing this to give a sort of first contact of how this model might be compared with real data. And as larger organisms have their regulatory networks examined, and hopefully that's going to be done in the future, these numbers are going to go up and the error bars are going to go down.
How is this data gathered? I mean, you don't have the ability to turn on a gene and see whether the other one...
Absolutely not. It's very hard. The keyword is chip measurements. Mm-hmm. What and then the and put into a microarray, and then the transcription factors are color coded and bind to and bind to elements of that chip. So that's one way, which is called a protein binding microarray. This data set comes from something more complicated in evolving a sort of immune response called called chip-chip chromatin immunoprecipitation. I'd be happy to tell you how it's done, but it's a very long and painstaking process, but it doesn't evolve just expression levels.
I'm probably missing something, but it seems to me that if all of those were positive, then you just get like a positive feedback loop.
Right.
You just have a runaway.
Right.
So
then you can't encode anything.
Then you can't encode anything,
right?
Right. So you certainly. I mean, why is the why is that a reasonable order parameter? Other than
I'm not saying it's reasonable. I'm saying it comes out.
Okay.
So, but I can tell you why it's a with hindsight.
I mean, it looks like a physics
reasonable.
Order parameter, of course. So I mean that.
Oh no, I'm not. You know, I'm not making.
But you're not making
it. I'm not making this up. It's
okay.
It's the only order parameter of the model. The reason it comes out is you have a condition which couples psi I mu, j I j, psi j mu.
Right.
These two guys are invariant under change exchange of labels if you exchange I with j, j with I,
mm-hmm.
which means something is going to happen at the level of which couples j, j, which couples those two guys.
But I should
That's the
think if this is a directed network or not.
Well, this is a directed network.
Yeah, so
Jij and Jji are a priori independent. But that doesn't mean they're necessarily uncorrelated.
Right. Okay.
They're free to take on any value, but the value which comes out in the end obeys this order parameter. And again, without this plot, I probably wouldn't have the courage to show you this.
Well, couldn't it be that if you looked at different order parameters, you might see a phase transition?
Well,
this happens to be a continuous one.
What I'm saying is, I compute the free energy as a function of alpha, and I don't see a shrinking of the phase space. I don't see what you have in the perceptron is that the free energy, namely the logarithm of the solution space.
Uh-huh.
Goes to minus infinity at alpha equals 2, and here it stays finite all the way. And there's a reason for it, namely that with every new constraint you get a new variable to play with. So it's counterintuitive at the beginning, but it's actually not that crazy. More questions?
So just a minute ago, you mentioned that the measurements have problems. Can you give me more specific?
Well, the point is that those interactions are really, really come with an energy scale. So each interaction involves a transcription factor protein binding to regulatory DNA. And now the question is, what's the energy of this interaction? That's extremely hard to measure. So what the experiments do is some sort of coarse grading. At some concentration of this transcription factor, if you chop the regulatory sequence into pieces, at some concentration of the transcription factor, if you take the sequence, fix whatever is bound there to it by biochemistry, essentially, then extract only bits with a given sequence, then release those bounds and ask what factors are bound to it by using their antibodies, you get a yes-no response, a protein was present or was not present. It comes with a certain amount of noise, simply because you might have just randomly extracted something from that solution, and it doesn't tell you anything about the energy, about the interaction. And you don't know whether the concentrations which you use to make those measurements are those which are relevant to the search.
So you take this data just as they are?
I take the data, at the moment I take the data just as they are. in order to make some very rough comparison. And new data is going to come and I'll look at it again in more detail.
So SR means SR published or SR?
As they published.
Which is, as we know, not SR.
This is absolutely true. This is absolutely true. On the other hand, you know, all I'm doing is very simple counts.
Mm-hmm.
And the error bars are big and all that. But at the moment I'm running with it and not spending more energy on polishing this data. I'm rather working from you. Yes, please.
How do we determine the number of regulatory genes?
Right.
Time?
So at the moment this is just how do you do it in principle?
In
the model, it's a parameter. It's a free parameter of the model, which I'm not changing right now. So this plot was done at the same number of regulatory genes with respect to structural genes, so 50-50. And in fact, different organisms have different ratios of structural genes to regulatory genes, and higher organisms have a higher ratio. And it'd be interesting to see if this ratio is determined, for instance, by the total number of cell states which you want to incur. But that's really just the beginning and a wide range of questions can be asked.
So higher organisms have more regulatory genes?
Have a higher fraction of regulatory genes, yes. But it's even hard to measure. We don't know that exactly because we don't know what genes code for transcription factors in all genomes. That's a tough question by itself. For some model organisms, people know very well, but even there, there might be surprises. Here, there's another result of a rough simulation, which asks what is the response to changing the target levels of structural genes. So you have some organism, and then some change in the environment occurs, and it has to change the levels of structural genes in all of the cellular states. And now the question is, how does it do that? It could change the levels of regulatory genes, or it could change the interactions, or probably both. And what is plotted here is the change in the regulatory genes, their expression levels, to the changes in the structural genes for different values of the loading parameter of the number of cell states relative to the total number of genes. And it shows a fairly flat change in the regulatory genes with respect to changes in the structural genes levels, but the level of the flatness, and here there's really a wide scatter simply because those are fairly small system sizes and very recent numerical simulations. I hope to improve that, but it shows a trend that at higher levels of states of the cell, so more responses, more different environments which the cell has to cope with, there's more changes in the regulatory expression levels. And this is something which in principle can be compared with data, where people have looked at the changes of regulatory levels compared with the changes in structural genes expression levels. And there's one study looking at different primates, comparing humans to other primates, and they show fairly large changes in the regulatory levels. And a different study on Drosophila shows that the changes in the regulatory levels are small compared to those in the structural genes. And that's compatible with the idea that Drosophila is a simpler organism, therefore has a smaller number of cellular states, and as a result, a lower level of changes in the structural genes. But of course, we'll have to both understand the model better and also wait for more data comparing expression levels across different species in order to see whether this is just a coincidence or whether it actually points to something deeper and more interesting. And with this, I I'd like to close and come to the three P's: people, publication, and pecuniary matters. I'd like to thank my postdoc Franz Dauffer, who was heavily involved in this project, as well as the other people in my group. There's some publication, one of them a few years back, on the adaptive evolution of transcription factor binding sites. There's a paper on the model, which I talked about in the second part, which is in preparation. There's a third paper, which I'd briefly like to mention, because it uses statistics of networks in order to compute scoring functions to compare networks across species. And many thanks to the funding agencies, and thank you very much for your attention.